Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Carolyn Waters. I'm a librarian. And part of my job here this evening is to remind you to please turn your cell phones off. Anything that might distract the presentation. So please help us with that.
That's a good idea.
Panelists, too. So we are thrilled to have this panel tonight for Mystery Writers of America. Obviously, you all know it's the oldest and most prominent organization for crime writers in America. And our own book stacks are stuffed to the gills with mystery books that really are a testament to the reading tastes of our members over the decades and the years. So those of you that that are not familiar with the library should come back and get a tour for sure. It is my pleasure to introduce Joseph Goodrich, our moderator for this evening's panel. Joseph is an alumnus of the New Dramatists and naturally a member of the Mystery Writers of America. His short story, Murder in the Sixth, appeared in the 2011 Mystery Writers of America anthology, The Rich and the Dead, edited by Nelson DeMille. His plays have been produced across the United States and in Australia and are published by Samuel French, Playscripts, and Applause Books, among others. His plays include Panic, which was the winner of the 2008 Edgar Award for Best Play, and Smoke and Mirrors. He is the editor of Blood Relations, The Selected Letters of Ellery Queen, 1947 to 1950, published by Perfect Crime Books. His nonfiction has appeared in Mystery Scene and Crime Spree, and he's a former Calderwood Fellow at the McDowell Colony. So please join me in welcoming Joseph Goodrich.
Perhaps you're wondering why I've gathered you all here this evening.
In this locked room.
As the lightning crackles and the thunder rolls. Thank you, Carolyn. On behalf of the New York chapter of Mystery Writers of America, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library, as if we didn't know where we were. This is the inaugural event, the first collaboration between the NYSL and MWA-NY, and speaking on behalf of the latter organization, it's a delight to visit this lovely and historic building. Thanks to Carolyn Waters, head librarian, and to Sarah Holliday, events coordinator, and to the rest of the staff and members for making this collaborative venture possible. Lovely and historic as this building is, I'm delighted to see that it is also a living organization that provides a home for readers, writers, researchers, and mystery fans. If I'm not mistaken, the very extensive collection housed here serves as the genesis for tonight's event. I think you'll agree with me that this is an eminently suitable locale to discuss the golden age of mysteries and to trace that golden age's bloodline through the years, to follow its spoor through the works and the decades that followed. Shakespeare said that brevity is the soul of wit. Dorothy Parker said brevity is the soul of lingerie. I say brevity is the soul of introductory remarks, so I'll try to keep mine as brief as possible. Time, the element of time, is much on my mind these days. Perhaps it's the subtle shifting of the seasons. Perhaps it's the very fact of contemplating tonight's topic, the Golden Age of Mysteries. For you see, when I first began reading mysteries, such golden age figures as Agatha Christie, Niall Marsh, John Dixon Carr, and Fred Dinet were still alive, if not necessarily well, and writing. The heirs to another kind of tradition, Ross Macdonald and Jim Thompson, for example, were also still around. And youngsters like Larry Block and Joe Gores were in the full flood of their talents. I'm struck by the fact that a fairly diligent reader can encompass the history of the mystery genre from, say, E.A. Poe to A.A. Fair to P.D. James and beyond. This means the form can be freely possessed and used. As a certain death-obsessed scrivener of the last century once put it, it's a movable feast, accessible to all. It's a democratic art form, even when its subjects are blue bloods. MWA New York board member Tom Straw has assembled a crackerjack crew of writers to discuss the Golden Age and its legacy, and it's my pleasure to introduce them to you now in the very strictest of alphabetical order.
It always happens to me.
Winner of the Edgar, Seamus, and Ellery Queen Awards, Charles Ardine is the author of 5 novels, including Little Girl Lost and Songs of Innocence. He's the founding editor of Hard Case Crime, the acclaimed pulp fiction imprint, which has published the work of authors ranging from Stephen King and Michael Crichton to Mickey Spillane, James M. Cain, and Gore Vidal. He also created the internet service Juno. He was one of the writers and producers of the TV series Haven, and earlier this year, staged an acclaimed all-female production of Shakespeare's The Tempest in Central Park. Julia Dahl is a journalist specializing in crime and justice. Her first novel, Invisible City, was nominated for an Edgar, a Thriller, and an Anthony Award, and won the Barry, the Seamus, and the McCabe Awards for Best First Novel. It was also named one of the Boston Globe's Best Books of 2014. Julia was born and raised in Fresno, California. I think that's Saroyan country, isn't it?
Yeah.
She now lives in Brooklyn, New York, which is not Saroyan country, and writes for CBSNews.com. Conviction, the third novel in her Rebecca Roberts series, will be published early next year. Parnell Hall is the author of the Puzzle Lady Crossword Puzzles Mysteries, the Stanley Hastings Private Eye novels, and the Steve Winslow courtroom dramas. His first thriller, Smooth Operator, co-written with New York Times best-selling author Stuart Woods, came out August 2nd. And good news occurred recently. This past weekend, Parnell won the 2016 Seamus Award for Best Short Story at BoucherCon in New Orleans for a story called The Dead Client from the anthology Dark City Lights, New York Stories. Congratulations, Parnell. His novel, A Puzzle to be Named Later, will be out in January of 2017. The very patient Elizabeth Zelda is the author of the Bruce Kohler mystery series and the historical novels Voyage of Strangers and Journey of Strangers. Her short stories have appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, and various e-zines and anthologies. Liz's work has been nominated twice for the Derringer Award and 3 times for the Agatha Award for Best Short Story. In 2017, she will edit the 4th Murder New York Style Anthology, A Killer Place to Visit, for Sisters in Crime's New York chapter. Her most recent book is Journey of Strangers, which she has described as a historical novel about the kidnapping and enslavement of 2,000 Jewish children by the King of Portugal. Crime fiction, if you want to call it that. A new short story in the Bruce Kohler mystery series will appear in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in 2017. As you can see, this is a talented and accomplished group of writers. You couldn't ask for a better lot to discuss the Golden Age of Mysteries. What I thought we'd do is I'd ask them some questions, we'd talk a bit, and then we'd open up the floor for questions from the audience. I gather this is a very savvy mystery crowd, so.
Excellent.
They'll be winning. The Golden Age of Mystery and its bloodlines. Let's begin at the base level. To paraphrase Raymond Carver, what are we talking about when we talk about the Golden Age of Mysteries? How do we define it? What are its parameters? Where do you place yourself within the context of that history?
I could start, since my name starts with a C. Okay. I consider the Golden Age of detective fiction at its height in the 1920s and 1930s, dominated by the queens of crime, Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, and Niall Marsh. And when I looked it up in Wikipedia, which is sometimes very helpful, including Josephine Tay, Michael Innes, Edmund Crispin, Cyril Hare, and other British writers, Christiana Brand is another one who comes to mind, and the Americans such as Ellery Queen, British, and S.S. Van Dyne was American. And also, according to Wikipedia, we would put the hard-boiled writers, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, in that golden age, and also Simenon. They covered the period. There were many of them, and I think the I didn't get around to. I really meant to look up the Detection Club, which was dominated by Dorothy Sayers. And one thing that I think the pure puzzle, I think I won't go down the mean streets. I'll let the hard-boiled guys talk about that. But I think the pure puzzle was an important element of that, of John Dixon Carr, certainly the locked room. There were other elements. Agatha Christie inventing the least likely suspect. But Christiana Brand, in one of her novels, had a foreword where she said, what you do is this. You have a number of suspects. With each one, you carefully place each clue so that they could have done it. And the detective follows them. And there is one thing that proves they couldn't have done it. And when you've eliminated all the suspects, there is one left. And the last clue is the one that shows they are the murderer. Well, first of all, neither an agent nor an editor would read that form. And nowadays, I don't think 99 readers out of 100 would notice, but this was essential during the golden age of history. So,
or certainly during a large cross section.
The puzzle end of the
yes, show. Right. Yeah,
I'm happy that was essential.
I'm happy that you mentioned. As part and parcel of the Golden Age, the hard-boiled side. Because I mean, if we're looking, say, from the end of World War I to the beginning of the interwar period, we have Dene and Lee and Larry Queen, the brain-bustingly difficult puzzles, and then we have Chandler and Hammett and David Goodis and a lot of other folks working as well. Would you include them in the Golden Age, Charles? Well, how would you?
Sure, it's a difficult yeah. question. Passionate fans of puzzle mysteries or cozy mysteries, which are not necessarily the same thing, although they overlap, and passionate fans of hard-boiled mysteries sometimes come to blows. Generally, it's not a good idea for these two groups to come to blows because the hard-boiled guys have bigger cudgels. Chandler and Hammett had. In particular, Chandler, a level of disdain for the puzzle mysteries, the British mysteries, that was entirely undeserved. They expressed it in witty ways, and so their essays continue to be charming. So if you want to read a takedown of the classic British mystery, you can read Chandler's essay from, I think, 1944 or thereabouts, called The Simple Art of Murder, where he said, we're trying to take back murder for people who commit it for a reason, not just to supply a corpse. This is line. But the truth is, they both were trying to do the same thing. At their best, I think, the classic detective story authors inject a moral dimension into their stories. Yes, they're puzzles, and they're hugely entertaining as puzzles, but they grip you emotionally as well. If you think of G.K. Chesterton, for instance, his Father Brown stories are all puzzles, but you emerge from the last page of a Father Brown story when they're very good, at the very best, with the same kind of deep sense of character and consequence that you have when you read any great literary short story. And conversely, while Chandler famously didn't know who committed the murder in The Big Sleep and couldn't have told you, I think if you read the best hard-boiled writers, there's a carefully structured plot. So they pretend to be animals, but deep down, I think they're doing the same thing.
Julian, where would you place yourself on the hard-boiled versus cozy question? Or is that a false dichotomy?
No, I mean, I think that they're just, it's a personal preference, right? You know, what kind of story do you like? I mean, I think of this in a slightly more meta, maybe more frustrating way. I don't feel like I know enough to tell you what the golden age of crime fiction was, but I do think that the question I'm interested in a you know, every age is interesting. Every age, every community is interesting, and what you're looking for as a crime fiction author is, what are the fears of that time? What, you know, what are we afraid of? Are we afraid of terrorism or police or our spouse? Or are we afraid of environment, you know, the environment, germs? And the best crime fiction authors, I think, so you know, sometimes those fears overlap in, sometimes those fears are different as, you know, in different times, but often they're very much the same. And so the, to me, what's interesting about crime fiction is how authors manipulate that fear, how we mine that fear, and how we use it to explore the fears of those times. And you know, so really, instead of, for me, the, not what the golden age is, but who in each age is spinning those fears into gold, into interesting crime fiction.
Who best captures those fears?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I would love to think of myself as part of that, but I'm not sure I'm quite there.
Parnell?
Oh dear. There's a common misconception that because a person has written the book, he must know something. I'm here to refute that. I don't know a lot. What defines the golden age? I would define it as authors who aren't on this panel. I don't know that much about the golden age. I write private eye books, but I did not read Hammett and Chandler. I, despite how old I am, I read Spencer. I read Robert E. Parker. I came a step removed. And when I wrote my first private eye book, I was imitating Parker, not the golden age. I never read them until after I got published and realized that if I hadn't read them, I'd wind up on a panel like this. And so I'm removed from that. What I did grow up on and what I had read, which I consider the golden age, is Earl Stanley Gardner's books. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about that considerably further on down the line. But the Perry Mason novels, the early Perry Mason novels, from the Golden Age, from the first half of the 20th century, before there was a TV series, which got it almost right. The later ones got it really wrong because they had the TV movies had Hamilton Berger and Perry Mason as buddies, and Perry was a respected pillar of the community. And good Lord, give me a break, they hate each other. And the early shows had him as a lawyer, at least. And some of the early movies that they had from when they had those early books that I love were absolute nonsense. They had him as a gourmet chef in one of them. I mean, these were terrible, but what he really was, and what I'll get into, was a crook, and that's
the well, he was a far more rampish figure than the very steady.
Oh my God! He's been in jail. That's a wonderful thing. That's what I loved about it. I was 10 years old when I started buying these things and they were 25 cents a piece. And I would go up there with my dollar, and I could get four of them in a 5-gallon can. And I bring them up to the counter, and they all had girls with low cut this, that, and the other thing, and a lot of legs. And the sales clerks would look at me like, it was wonderful.
Well, you've touched on the second part of the title discussion of the bloodline, which is you came through to the private eye through Robert Parker,
that's right.
Whose thesis was written on Hammett and Chandler. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So maybe you're a descendant of a descendant,
as it may be. I had read him. I had read Lawrence Block. Sure. I had read those guys, the contemporaries. But I had not read the Golden Age classic. Who I also consider Golden Age is Agatha Christie.
Sure. Yeah. Is Agatha Christie? She seems to be the gateway drug for many, many distributors. Let me ask.
I want to talk about where do you position yourself, and is it a false dichotomy?
Yeah.
Because it is a false dichotomy, but not because there's anything wrong with the two ends, which are Chandler and Christie. It's because everybody disregards the middle.
Yeah.
And the middle is Dorothy L. Sayers, who I consider my progenitor, and I write character-driven traditional mysteries. And I think that I can point to the exact moment when Dorothy L. Sayers broke the mold of the puzzle and began to write a puzzle embedded in a character-driven novel. And I will read it to you, and I went by the time she wrote it. This is from Gaudy Night, which I was very happy to see on display over here, one of the great mystery novels. And I already told, I guess I told Charles before when we were talking, that I wouldn't take it on a desert island because I probably know it by heart. But this passage, which she put into her fictional characters, Harriet Vane, who's a novelist, mystery novelist, asked Lord Peter Wimsey's advice about her novel, and I believe this is the conversation that Dorothy L. Sayers had in her head that caused her to change the course of traditional mystery fiction. So she's asked an advice, which the novel isn't going well, which is something we all have experienced. Well, said Harriet, I admit that Wilfred is the world's worst goop, but if he doesn't conceal the handkerchief, where's my plot? And Peter suggests a way to define Wilfred's character so he'd have some motivation for hiding the handkerchief. He'd still be a goop, and a pathological goop, but he would be a bit more consistent. Yes, he'd be interested, but if I give Wilfred all those violent and lifelike feelings, he'll throw the whole book out of balance. And Peter says, you would have to abandon the jigsaw kind of story and write a book about human beings for a change. And then she realized she had to kind of drag it out of her butt and churn herself up in order to do that. And she says, it would hurt like hell. And Peter says, what would that matter if it made a good book? And I think that is when mystery fiction changed. And when the idea of trying to drag on the reins and make mystery writers write a puzzle instead of a character-driven novel became a real waste of time for writers like me who want to read and write character-driven novels.
Lawrence Block said something like that about 20 years ago when he was asked about his Matthew Scudder series, which is one of the great landmarks, private eye series in the history of the genre. The early books are puzzle mysteries after a fashion. They're character driven, but they have puzzles, and the later books less so. And he said, I felt you have to choose between constructing an intricate puzzle and having a degree of realism. And I chose to go in that direction, the direction of telling a story about a character's life. I don't think as a writer you have to choose, because you can write both types of book. But I do think the books that are, I use the word merely, with some care, because I love puzzle mysteries, but the books that are merely puzzles and don't have that extra level of character tend not to last as well. They aren't bad books, they're fun to read, but you don't remember them a week later. And the ones that give you characters you live with, you remember for the rest of your life.
You know, I have a whole thing about that. And again, from Gaudy Night, can I ask, how many of the men in the audience have read Gaudy Night?
Men.
To
be fair, the audience is heavily female.
I know, but how many in the audience have read Gaudy Night? Okay. Yeah, I know. But the thing is that, you know, I think many of the fans of hard-boiled fiction are not acquainted with Dorothy Sayers. She is terrific. And, you know, one of the things that comes up a lot in critique of mystery fiction, they give Dorothy L. Sayers a hard time for falling in love with Lord Peter Wimsey. You know, and the point that I make about a writer falling in love with a character is these are the characters that last because the readers fall in love with the character too. And there's another example that I really love. And Dorothy L. Sayers had a terrible man. Lawrence Block is also one of my progenitors, in that he wrote about alcoholism and recovery. And this is my professional field. My mystery series is about a recovering alcoholic. And it's very much something I wanted to write about recovery, only I wanted to make it funny, which when I started, nobody else had done. Now others have done it. And Matt Scudder isn't funny. You know, his relationship with AA is not funny. Bruce's is. And but she had a terrible marriage to an alcoholic and an invalid. And she also had, you know, the things that had happened to Harriet with the lover who was testing her by saying he wouldn't marry her. And you know, then she got pregnant and, you know, he wouldn't marry her and you know, left when he learned she was. All the things that happened to Harriet that happened to Dorothy L. Sayers. And she got even, you know, by killing off Philip Boyce. And she's skewered her again in Lustman's honeymoon when she and Peter are on their honeymoon. And she, Lord Peter, has the opportunity to observe that Harriet had not experienced sexual generosity before. And the readers of Chandler, who don't think there's any difference between Sayers and Christie, have not read this passage. I don't see how any reader can resist. He knew now, this is after wedding, he knew now that she could render back passion for passion with an eagerness beyond all expectation, and also with a kind of astonished gratitude that told him more than she knew. Peter, interpreting phenomena in the light of expert knowledge, found himself mentally applying to boys quite a number of epithets, among which clumsy lout and egotistical puppy were the kindest. How could you not love that? And this is why we're still reading her 70 years later.
One very quick remark. There are sexist fools who won't pick up Dorothy Sayers because she's a female author. But one of her most passionate fans is Stephen King.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do know.
He set out at one point to write a Lord Peter Wimsey novel himself. And I think he wrote about 10 pages of it before discovering he didn't have the rights. So that's the
end. Julian, are you a Christie fan? What got you into the field?
Yes, my parents are here, and they allowed me to, I think I joined the Agatha Christie Book of the Month Club when I was like 9. I mean, like kind of inappropriate. Yeah, so I mean, I read all those, and she was my gateway drug. And then as a young teenager, I grew up in the 80s, and there were books by a man named Christopher Pike, and who wrote some really fantastic YA books, and Dean Koontz, and then of course I graduated to Stephen King. Yeah, so that was my gateway, yeah.
No one has mentioned Conan Doyle yet. I mean, surely, I think everyone must have read The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes at some point as a kid.
I read them, Don't Call Me Sherlock.
Right. Yeah, I also started with Nancy Drew. That was a big, you know, I mean, those are harder mysteries, but the female protagonist, you know, there aren't a lot of those in the as a young girl growing up, there aren't, you know, especially at school, you read books by and about boys. But Nancy Drew was fantastic. And actually, when I was growing up, they had rebooted the series. They rebooted it several times. But there were the classic mysteries, and then there were the Nancy Drew files. So Nancy Drew was, you know, now, you know, had like big hair and a convertible that was slightly different than her previous convertible. She did things like go skiing. And so Nancy Drew was a big gateway for me.
Encyclopedia Brown was a gateway drug for many young boys. Probably maybe girls too, but certainly. Scholastic books made a lot of money, and probably continues to make a lot of money off of
this. I liked Nancy Drew.
You watched them on TV, they are on TV.
Oh, my grandmother's house, there were all these old books. It was, you know, and as a very young, I read them and thought, you know, hey, that's more interesting than the crap I'm reading in school.
Here's kind of an interesting question, although it's off to one side. You mentioned the subscription service. There used to be an Old Stanley Gardner subscription service.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. In the early days, there was even a Stephen King subscription service. Is there any subscription service anymore? Is there some way for a fan to just every month get a new book by an author that he or she loves?
No, but I'm willing to do it.
That's a good idea, but fantastic. You have to be able to get it in Agatha Christie's Book of the Month Club, don't you?
Mary Mason's also were serialized in magazines.
That's true, too.
think the closest might be the Mysterious Bookshops. They have kind of a genre of the month. If you like a cozy, if you like a thriller, if you like this or that, you can subscribe and they will send you every month.
One of my novels was with Five Star, which just stopped publishing mysteries. And if you wanted your paperback worldwide to take the series, and it is subscription, but in fact, they didn't want my series, which is, as I said, about a recovering alcoholic in New York, because they thought that their mystery subscribers, they also have a Christian.
Oh.
And, you know, there's some crossover in the subscribers.
God forbid.
They thought recovering alcoholics in New York would not please their Christian readership. So they didn't give me a contract for my mysteries. So, yeah, it's happening out there in the publishing world, you know.
You mentioned reading Nancy Drew. This is, I'm serious. Have you reread them? Would you reread them? And the larger question of what books do you return to? From the Golden Age or from the mystery world in general?
My grandmother's house is in Richland Center, Wisconsin, and I have not been back. I'm not sure the house still exists, so I wouldn't know. You know, I don't go out and buy Nancy Drew books because, you know, and no, I have not. But that's not to say that if it were put in front of me, I wouldn't pick it up and say, "Hey, old friend, how are you? Gee, I hope no one sees me reading this."
The reason I ask is, I mean, I reread a lot of Golden Age mysteries fairly frequently. I keep going back to, actually, I've got it right here, the lovely Valentine edition of Cat of Many Tales by Ellery Queen. I read it and I keep finding new things in it with every reading. And I'm wondering, is there a book for you that does that?
In preparation for this panel, yeah. I went back to probably this would be my Desert Island book, which is Strangers on a Train.
Oh, yeah.
I think of Patricia Highsmith as, if Agatha Christie was my gateway drug, you know, Patricia Highsmith was the great high. so I think Strangers, you know, yeah. that is one that I go back to. And Suspension of Mercy and the Ripley books, sure. I will reread those. Talk about just, this sort of, she's such a master at creating this aura of menace. You know something bad is about to happen, and yet everything is sort of polite most of the time until that moment happens. And also, I was talking about sort of the fears of the time. One of the things that I thought that's so great about Strangers on the Train is the idea of this sort of, a murder that begins when you're just sort of, pardon my French, like shit-talking. You're on the train. What if I kill somebody? And then all of a sudden you fall into that, which is so terrifying, especially to somebody who, sort of chats with strangers all the time. Oh, maybe this would happen, maybe this would happen, and all of a sudden your whole life is taken over.
Yeah. She certainly captured the fears of her era.
Yes. Yes.
Charles, is there an author or a book that you return to?
I must reread. I'll do a couple of things. I read Big Sleep, I reread frequently.
Okay.
And I'm never disappointed. It's a beautiful book. It's poetic. It's the closest thing that I found in mystery writing to F. Scott Fitzgerald. The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. Gorgeous, gorgeous book. I do reread Queen. I find very few people actually read Ellery Queen anymore. It's a great shame. I was carrying around a Queen book. I think it was The Finishing Stroke.
Oh, yeah?
And I was in a subway station in Columbus Circle. Went downstairs to get a bite to eat because there was some sign upstairs saying, "Get a bite to eat downstairs." And there was a place there, and the name was Hillary's Greens. And I thought, that's got to be connected. So I went up to them, and I pulled out the book, and I said, "Hey." They didn't know what I was talking about. Now, to be fair, I also was in an airport once and saw a place called the Brioche Door, Golden Brioche. And I went up to them, and I said, "Can I have a brioche?" And they said, "Oh, what?" So the world is full of very odd people. But in any case, I do reread Chandler. There's a book, and this was my Desert Island choice, and it's an eccentric one. There's a children's book author named Ellen Raskin. Oh, I hear there are some Ellen Raskin fans. Ellen Raskin wrote several books, all good. But her masterpiece was a book called The Westing Game. And although it's for children, it is one of the most extraordinary mysteries I've ever read. it's worth rereading. If you've only read it as a child, you read it. It's wonderful. I hear you.
Oh, I loved it. And now I'm going to go read it immediately.
It's beautiful.
It did like my brain. Yeah.
Liz, is there a problem?
Okay. I'm saving myself. But in fact, I own all of the Patricia Wentworths that I can get my hands on, not only the Silvers, but I have all of them. And I have reread them many times, only now I remember the ending of too many of them. So, great comfort reads. Dorothy L. Sayers, all of them. Josephine Tate, you know, I must have, because I do reread all of them. Well, like some of Bradford probably know my heart.
I always think of Josephine Tate as the anti-Highsmith. She writes warm, beautiful books about people you would like to know.
See, to me, the endearing character is essential. And I am proud to say, because I didn't know if I could do it when I started writing novels myself, but I seem to have, for the readers who like my work, I seem to have succeeded in creating endearing characters, and I'm so grateful, because you never know, you know. And that really, I mean, that's the height of my ambition. And my favorite novelists, in and out of mystery and historicals, which he does that way, you know, I love them, I want to go home with them, I want to be part of their family, and to me, that is essential.
You read Stout?
You know, I actually eventually gave away my whole set of Nero with paperbacks from the 50s. I read them more than once, but I am not in love with them. I got the boy books.
Interesting. I've spent a lot of time. I'm not the biggest Rex Stout fan in the world, but I did the very first stage adaptation of A Nero Wolf, now The Red Box, which was done in St. Paul, Minnesota in 14, and Might As Well Be Dead opens in June of 2017, if any of you happen to be in St. Paul, Minnesota. But boy books, I thought of them that way. But Archie Goodwin is very much youth in the city.
Well, you know, he talks about women being on the shady side of 30.
Well, good. You brought a point. You brought up a marvelous point, which ties into one of the questions, which is in looking at books that are written in different times and different eras with different ideas about what is proper sexually, socially, economically. Do servants matter? No, of course they don't. They can't be the killer because they don't matter. Any of those kind of things. How do you individually deal with those questions of works that may be homophobic, maybe anti-Semitic, that one of you may be decidedly anti-feminist, like the Stout books? What does one do with those books? How does one deal with that?
So I would say that at some level, yes, we have to take each work of art as a product of its time.
Yes.
But I don't think that means that we can't fault an author for his or her prejudices. Because, you know, what is prejudice if not really just the lack of imagination? I mean, a prejudice is looking at someone and not being able to imagine that they have an interior life like yours, or that they are more complicated than their religion or their skin color or their sexual preference or their genitalia, et cetera. And, you know, in any time that people should have imagination, and what do we look to our artists for but imagination? So I think that, you know, it's part of the historical record, of course. We read a book and women are treated a certain way, gays are treated a certain way, and it's important that we know that that was how they were treated. But I don't think that we can let the author off the hook because his or her time, I mean, I kind of find that a little ridiculous. I mean, what is, you know, there is no such, the time, a certain era does not make an idea. It's people and how they think and behave, you know, that makes that idea. So I don't think we get to let them off the hook, although I do think it's an important part of the record.
Charles?
It cuts the other way as well, in an interesting fashion I just discovered recently. One of the things I do at Hard Case Crime is a kind of archaeological work where we try to discover and unearth lost works from authors from this period and bring them to light. So we've published never-before-published books by Donald Westlake, James M. Cain, and things like that. To my surprise, and you'll be excited about this, to my surprise, there exists an unpublished book by Earl Stanley Gardner. Now, given the pace at which he wrote, it's almost inevitable, a man wrote 10,000 words a day. But he wrote a book in 1939, talking about the prejudices of the time. In 1939, he wrote a sequel to his first A.A. Fair mystery. Mm-hmm. He wrote this side series under the name A.A. Fair that had a tough male disbarred lawyer who was thrown out of the bar because he instructed someone in how to commit murder and get away with it. Mm-hmm. So he got disbarred. And he teams up with a woman named Bertha Kuhl, who runs her own detective agency. And the first book was a bestseller, and he wrote a sequel. And he sent the sequel to his editor, publisher at Morrow, Thayer Hobson. And Thayer Hobson wrote the most extraordinarily scathing rejection letter. Now, keep in mind, Earl Stanley Gardner was the best-selling mystery writer in America at the time. And this rejection letter said, "You will do your reputation no favors if we publish this book. We will publish it if you tell us to, but I recommend that you put it in a drawer and forget about it." Why? Because your female detective does nothing but swear and gyp people. She's only out for herself. What kind of example is this? And the whole thing is vulgar. I read it. We're publishing it in December. You can buy it for yourself. It's called The Knife Slit, the brand new Earl Stanley Gardner book. And how many times has that happened? What was vulgar in this book? There's a female character who has a relationship with the male detective. Her boyfriend describes her as a nymphomaniac. Yes, that's shocking. The detective says, "A nymphomaniac? How many men have you known?" She says, "Four." And in 1939, yes, in 1939, he couldn't get it published. And so, we not only won't I forgive Thayer Hobson for doing it, I will thank his memory because now I get to publish it.
Can't wait.
It's a lot of fun. It's a fun book.
The Bigger They Come, the first one, where he gets disbarred because he tells this crook how you could commit a murder and get away with it. He is disbarred because they don't believe that he's right.
But he is.
By the end of the book, he stands up in court and confesses to a murder and walks out scot-free. It's wonderful.
It is a great book.
And wonderful.
Is it a righteous murder?
Excuse me, I didn't say anything like that. You have to read
it. The Bigger They Come.
The Bigger They Come. And it's the first A.A. Fair, Earl Stanley Gardner, writing this A.A. Fair, Donna Lambert, the Cool Book. And they are wonderful books.
Interestingly, random snippet, Donald Lamb, the male character in the team, was played by two famous actors who are nothing alike. On radio by one, and on a brief television appearance by another. Can you think of any character in the history of mystery fiction who could be played both by Art Carney, on one hand, on television, and Frank Sinatra, on radio? U.S. Steel, Hour of Mystery, 1946. Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
So there's the gold page.
I can't wait to see Robert Redford and Nathan Lane as a little queen. Liz, this is your question, but Julia and Kyle and Charles, I'll let you weigh in on it as well. There's been a renaissance or a rediscovery of women crime writers past and present. Margaret Miller and Patricia Highsmith are back in print, and Gillian Flynn, Megan Abbott, among others, have joined P.D. James and others in achieving mainstream success. Why now? Why is it happening now? And what are some of the reasons, you think?
Well, I read this question, which Joe sent to us in advance, and I got my scrappy hat on. Because for me, this question, as it was phrased, is absolutely loaded with bias. I love you guys dearly, but and I'm a great admirer, particularly of Megan Abbott and her wonderful work. I just read her most recent book, which is terrific. But for us, women crime writers were never lost. And the examples that you've chosen for me are some of the very small group of women that I think male readers and male writers have chosen to read and approve of because they're somehow tough and transcend the female sensibility, much as crime fiction writers who write well are said to, quote, transcend the genre, which, and you know how much we all love that. So, I think the main reason that you guys are paying attention to women crime writers now, one of the reasons is that 30 years ago, women writers founded Sisters in Crime, which is an organization whose mission was, and I quote, to promote the professional development and advancement of women crime writers to achieve equality in the industry. That was in 1986. And we have been kicking and screaming ever since. And we've made some progress, but we're not there yet. And among the, there are hundreds of terrific crime writers. I think the ones who men like and acknowledge, besides Megan Abbott and Gillian Flynn and Margaret Miller and Patricia Highsmith or Laura Lippman. I mean, these are wonderful writers and wonderful women. Alison Galen, Alfred Burke, for example. But here are the ones that we like too, and we never found them missing. They didn't disappear for us. Deborah Promy, Laurie R. King, Julia Spencer Fleming, Jane Casey, Tana French, Sarah Paretsky, Marcia Muller, Sue Grafton, Margaret Maron, Nevada Barr, Katrina McPherson, Donna Leon, and I can name a lot more. And I already asked how many have read Dorothy L. Sayers' books. Have you read all of them? Josephine Tay, have you read all of them? And you know, they must be available for Kindle, because I mean, I got them all.
I hope so.
I got them all. I went and got them all on Kindle. I got the best of Naima. I mean, there are a lot that I want to see how they held up. So I am rereading.
And let's not forget Lillian Jackson Braun and Mary Higgins Clark.
Not my taste, not my favorites. Yeah. Sarah Paretsky, very, very good. And Donna Leon and Margaret Maron, I think, are both extraordinary. And anybody who hasn't read them, I encourage you to read them.
Do you have a comment?
Yeah, don't take her attack to heart. She's just a woman. All of those people that you were naming, I'm a member of Sisters in Crime.
Well, he even sings at Malice Domestic, so part of it's a free pass for everything.
Yeah, no, but many of those writers that you were naming off as the ones that, you know, we have, I've read them all, you know, and a lot of people have read them all.
Yeah, and I mentioned Gillian Flynn because she's had a movie made. Megan Abbott is in the worst. If people make more movies from Elizabeth Daly's work, which I love, or Elizabeth Sanksay Holding, whom Chandler and I and many others adore, then I would be mentioning them as well. But your point is taken. Julia?
Well, so I can't speak exactly to the rediscovery, but I think in terms of mainstream success, I think basically the generation, this is a generational thing at some level, the generation of young and middle-aged men who, you know, are coming up now, or I think maybe are less put off by books with female, you know, with a female author, woman on the cover, a female protagonist. I was at the Mystery Writers Convention in New Orleans over the weekend, and there was a great panel moderated by Lee Child, but the panel was all women. It was Karen Slaughter, Kate White, Alfair Burke, Sarah Bladell, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, she's from Denmark, Scandinavian, and Lisa Unger. And one of the things we talked a lot about was you know, women authors, do men read women authors, and you know, should you have a, have you, is it more lucrative or better, you know, better for your sales if you have, instead of your name being Julia Dahl, it's J.E. Dahl, so maybe you can trick some men into buying a book, because it's not a woman. And Karen Slaughter said that just recently she had a man come up to her and say, I never read books by women, but my wife gave me yours and I really liked it. And she said, you know, it's still not societally, maybe in this room it's unacceptable, but it's still not completely unacceptable for a man to say, I never read books by women. You know, that just, you know, a woman couldn't get away with that. You know, we couldn't, it's not like I could go through high school and say, I'm going to read this book about this annoying prep school guy. you know, that's not really my experience. You know, you don't get to do that. But I think there's becoming an understanding. I think Lisa Unger put it perfectly, which was that, you know, you read a book by a woman or about a woman to learn a little bit about the internal life of a woman. And if you're not interested enough in the internal life of 50% of the society or of women, you know, what does that say about your relationships in real life, that you're not interested in the internal life of a woman? So I think that it, at some level, this generation, I think that if you're born after 1960, certainly if you're born after 1980, you assume that your peers and your boss and your doctor and maybe even your president is going to be a woman. So reading about women and by women isn't like some sort of like liberal project. I, you know, I just want to learn what the girls are thinking. It's just part of, you know, why do we read? We read to learn more about our fellow human beings. So I have to say, I think this is at some level generational.
Yeah, I'm old, and growing up for me, a woman writer was Agatha Christie. The only Josephine Tay I read was Daughter of Time, because it was, you know, Richard III. But it wasn't until I got published and discovered all of these women writers that I started reading. Otherwise, I was largely reading men. Please interrupt.
I was going to say that I think, I mean, I'm sure men have this problem too, but Gillian Flynn's book, you know, the sort of the biggest book of the last 10 years was Gone Girl, right? And, you know, that was about, talk about an unendearing character, right? You know, and I think there is a sense that, I mean, certainly I don't fault anyone for wanting endearing characters, but I don't think that in order for a book to be successful, you have to have an endearing character. I think that especially, and I have heard, I can't tell you how many women, and I enjoyed Gone Girl. I thought she wrote both characters very well, and I thought it was, you know, so interesting psychologically about, you know, what a marriage is and what you know, how you can sleep next to someone and not know anything about who they really are. But I can't tell you how many women I know who would call the book anti-feminist, which, you know, we can have a million years of discussion about what feminism is, but I think that maybe, you know, what I love about Sisters in Crime is the camaraderie of women writers. But I think that in some ways women writers are held up to a certain kind of standard that we have to write other women who are role models. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're writing crime fiction, you're very often not, you know, you don't want to write role models. You want to write about the darkness of human beings.
Well,
so,
Now, I didn't read Gone Girl because enough people told me how dislikable. You know, I have absolutely no interest in reading about unendearing characters. Now, my other hat is I'm a shrimp. And sure, there are there are so many people who can, you know, be married to somebody. Not. I'm not interested in those. I mean, I can't tell you how many movies I see. Or oh, God, get to a therapist. But as for role models, I mean, my primary character in my mysteries is a recovering alcoholic, and his best friend and sidekick is a nice Jewish girl from Queens who's a world-class codependent, and she is not a role model. I mean, she's got no boundaries and no breaks, but if I made her, you know, if I fixed her up, you know, she would be so uninterested. And she's hilariously funny because she's not. So, I mean, the human being is an extremely complex creature. And it's the complexity, whether you use it for humor or for emotional depth and passion, that makes it interesting. Okay. And it's because we're really interested in people that we write fiction. So, you know, I think we we all have to be careful not to oversimplify.
I must throw in to this gender gap the fact that after 18 books, when my private eye series got dropped, the only reason I'm here today is because I wrote a book about a woman and put a woman's name on as the author and had my agent send it around. And I immediately got a big contract from Bantam for more money than they'd ever paid me.
So, I like it. That's love to
help you. Well, Darker Light, I'm amazed at a form, at a genre, that encompasses everything from mysteries that are solved by cats at one end, and at the other, the most sort of gorily perverse Hollywood death fantasies that you might find in the works of someone like James Ellroy. One last question before we open things up to the audience, and that would be, I'm grabbing you by the lapel question, which is, you haven't read this, you must read ... What would that book be, Parnell? The book you would recommend above any other?
Counterfeit Eye, Earl Stanley Darden.
So Counterfeit Eye, what was the author?
Counterfeit Eye by Earl Stanley Darden.
Earl Stanley Darden.
Very nascent history. It goes back to the time when Perry Mason was the guy who would go out and not just do anything for his client, but he would break into the crime scene. And when he was caught at it, he would whip out a notebook and say, "Oh no, no, I'm just conserving the estate for the widow." And he would lie, he would cheat, he would steal. Anyway, Counterfeit Eye.
Counterfeit Eye by Earl Stanley Gardner.
Yeah.
Julia?
Well, I already said Strangers on a Train.
Sure.
I'm going to say two, but I'll be real fast. So one is An American Tragedy by Theodore Dreiser. Not a traditional mystery by any means, but crime fiction, ripped, you know, I love that he does ripped from the headlines before Law and Order, you know, and just the idea of committing a murder to sort of advance your place in society feels so American to me. But the other is a book that came out in 2003 by Lionel Shriver called We Need to Talk About Kevin. It's the most terrifying book I've ever read in my entire life. It's basically the story of a teenager who commits a school massacre, and it's told from the mother's point of view. Basically, a mother learning that her child, realizing that her child is a monster, but she still loves him and wants to protect him. It's so terrifying and gripping.
Well, I think I have to say Gaudy Night if you haven't read it, although there's no murder in it. And for those who have read it, if you haven't read Josephine Tay's Grant Farrar, for the ultimate in endearing character.
What was the title of it?
Grant Farrar, F-A-R-R-A-R, Josephine Tay, T-A-Y, written in the 50s. T-E-Y, sorry. Sugar in your tay.
Cup of tay.
All right, I'll give you, since you're going to tell me to. Modern Day and an Old. Modern Day, I would recommend very highly that you pick up Lawrence Block's book, 8 Million Ways to Die.
Yeah.
It's one of the greats of modern detective writing. It is about a recovering alcoholic. It begins and ends with that transition of an alcoholic ending, his reluctance to get into treatment. But the story is just beautiful. And if you want to go back in time, here's an obscure one, but no one's ever regretted reading it. It's called The Red Right Hand, by a man named Joel Townsley Rogers. The Red Right Hand is peculiar, it is surrealistic, it is a puzzle mystery. It is not entirely what I would call a plain fair puzzle mystery, for reasons that I will not share with you because it would ruin it, but it is perhaps the most brilliantly constructed puzzle I have ever read. We'll leave it at that.
I would name, from the Golden Age, I would name actually two. One is The Beast Must Die by C. Day Lewis, or Nicholas Blake is his...
otherwise known as Daniel Day Lewis as Danny.
Yes, the poet, the former poet laureate of England and the father of Daniel Day Lewis. The Beast Must Die. There's also a very curious writer along the lines of Rogers. It's not a traditional mystery, but it's disturbing, I think, and evokes certain fears of its era, and that's The Deadly Percheron by John Franklin Barden. And then one more, a contemporary Private Eye novel, late 70s, early 80s, called Good Night and Good Luck by Timothy Harris.
Well, can I have one more?
Of course. You can all have one.
We're in a library.
I worked out a whole subgenre. Because besides the amateur sleuth with the character-driven novel, fully half of what I read is the police procedural character-driven novel. And I mentioned some of the practitioners, but I didn't mention a wonderful British writer who died in the last couple of years, Reginald Hill, and I would say his masterpiece is probably On Beulah Height. So I wouldn't take it to the desert island as I remember
it. Let's open things up to the audience and have some questions. Sir?
I must ask about Dorothy Sayers of Liz Zeldin. I think one of her biographers, James Brabazon, you know him?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, he was a younger man than she was, but he knew her in London. And he knew that the books came out of Dorothy's experience, and he liked them, but he wished he could have loosened up and written a real novel without the template of the mystery to be in there. And those words you gave from Gaudy Knight, I think Peter goes on to say that Harriet Vane responds, yes, Peter, I'll try to write a character like that, you know, more human, but it'll hurt like hell, cut near the bone, but I'll try. And I think that's 1931 when that book came out, something like that, when Dorothy gave those words to Harriet Vane. And in 1957, when she died, she hadn't written this novel. So if there is no James Brabazon, or I made that all up, do you share that frustration that she didn't write a real novel?
Well, this is a whole other evening, because crime writers have heard crime fiction not called real novels for a long time, and if you will look at this week's New York Times bestseller list, I think it's an unfair charge, and we do write real novels.
Well, just this year, the Edgar Award went to a book called Sympathizer, which also won the Pulitzer Award. I believe that is the first time that's ever happened, so the genre has been busted.
Well,
yes, ma'am.
Normally I mentioned an article, Michael Gilbert.
Oh, yes. Small Bone Disease.
Yes.
Was Michael Gilbert, and I agree. Most wrote wonderful short stories that I recall from his Melody book.
He was also Raymond Chandler's solicitor when Chandler was in London in the late 50s.
Nobody has mentioned Ruth Rendell.
Yeah. Also recently deceased,
yes.
Sad, Ruth Rendell.
Yeah, read them all and no more. Where would you put John Connolly, and do you think he has any predecessors?
Who would like to address that?
I think you would.
Well, I know John, actually, and I like his books. He's an entertaining fellow. He has a very strong interest in Irish folklore and myth. And he's a genre buster. His books really do, he's one of the very first, I think, to include the occult or the supernormal or the supernatural in his work. So to that extent, I'm not exactly sure whom to point to as his predecessors. He is really sort of sui generis.
I'll give you one.
Or John Dixon Carr.
Well, right, John Dixon Carr had the media of the books.
Sure.
And John Dixon Carr had an element of the occult. If you want to go back in sort of Irish literary history, you can find an author who was part of nobility, wrote brilliantly, but is best known for short fiction, whose name is either pronounced Lord Dunsany or Lord Dunsany, depending on whether you get it right or wrong. saying is, in fact, how he said it. I don't say it that way because he's dead, so he can't complain. Lord Dunsany's short fiction, some of it written literally in the trenches of World War I, where he had the misfortune of fighting and the good fortune of surviving, is beautiful, and it is interlaced with the Apollo. Some of it is quite grim, but it's worth reading.
The thing with Carr is that it may look like the occult, but there's always an alter human criminal behind
it. So, Scooby-Doo. I think there are some that are occult, but I don't remember.
Changing history, and
well, the ones that I've read, especially the radio shows for the suspense radio scripts, all have human agencies behind the occult.
Another writer who didn't mention is Kate Atkinson.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just
throw that. So there's just to build on Charles' statement, and there's one final point about John Connolly, is there's an Irish tradition of blending the occult and the real, and I think Connolly is part of that towards on the mystery side of it. The veil between worlds, especially on May Day, May Eve. I'm married to an Irish woman, so I know all this. The veil between worlds in Ireland and the Irish sensibility is very thin. It gets spooky sometimes. Sir?
I remember reading a wonderful series of books featuring a gay Roman detective who is confidant of the emperor and assigned by the emperor to probe different issues and take care of certain people. And ranging all through the Roman Empire, the fellow lives in Austin, Texas, and I can't remember his name.
This sounds great.
Do you know of any gay detective writers?
Historical?
Historical, especially writers dealing with, well, you're talking to a guy who taught the course of Roman school in high school.
Well, the groundbreaker is often thought to be George Bax, who created Farrell Love, which was one of the first gay detective characters.
Yeah, but that was contemporary.
But that's right. That wasn't this one. But you're asking for other gay authors.
And the three Roman detectives, Gordianus the Finder.
Right. That's the Sailor.
That's it. The Finder.
What is his name?
Gordianus the Finder. He's not gay.
No, but the author of that, and the detective is not gay, but it's all gay themes throughout the whole world.
Ah, okay.
Interesting.
I didn't know that.
And the library has
actually three of these books. Why don't you think that counts? I mean, the suggest very licentious.
we have a passionate question.
Oh, good.
Yes, about gay detectives. I think in the 70s or so, there was a character named Dave Brandstetter.
Yes, Joseph Hansen.
Okay.
Joseph Hansen is the author, Dave Brandstetter, and that was another pioneer in gay character, absolutely.
That's
it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, question up. The name of the Rose by Murdo Eco, which is a detective mystery novel by somebody who's not in the genre and a very interesting setting in the medieval months. Are there other books like that that you'd better recommend which are written by someone outside the genre with a very unique setting in which the mystery unfolds?
Well, if you want golden age, go to A.A. Milne, author of Winnie the Pooh, who wrote The Red House. It's a classic 1926 mystery, very much in the Agatha Christie vein, by the author of Winnie the Pooh. Detested, if I remember, by Chandler. Chandler didn't like The Red House mystery. But then Dorothy Parker didn't like Winnie the Pooh, so go ahead.
The Red House Mystery. I think some of Ian McEwan's books, you could, not necessarily just mystery, but suspense thriller aspects. You could use with the Cement Garden, I think would fit in there. The Company of Strangers, which is certainly a frightening novel.
For heaven's sake, what's The Great Gatsby if not a crime novel?
Right. Interesting enough, Ross MacDonald wrote about that in a collection of self-portrait, I think it was called. He talks about how Gatsby has, how does he describe it? It has the skeleton of a mystery, but not the central nervous system, or something like that. I thought it was very astute, because Reeve Earl Coleman often points out, what happens in The Great Gatsby? He winds up dead in the swimming pool. Somebody's killed him. Right. There's a murder. He's a bootlegger. It's the 20s.
Sounds like
yes, Anne.
To reference something that Julia said, generationally, first of all, there is a situation where a Pulitzer nominee, a winner of a Pulitzer nominee, was also happened to be the co-winner this year of the Lambda Literary Award, and that's Victoria Brownmore. And her other co-winner is me.
Congratulations.
I think it is generational. There is a whole genre of LGBT mystery writers. Jean Redmond, who writes this extraordinary Nicky Knight series, which you might be interested in because it deals with an uncovering alcoholic who's trying to be a PI and so on. We find among ourselves it's extremely difficult, very, very difficult, to have mainstream readers, male or female, read books, mystery or otherwise, but particularly mystery in a way, by LGBT writers who are writing about gay lives. In my case, I'm writing about a very gay criminal. That reflects back to the Golden Age because it takes place in the early 1950s. But do you find generationally, Julia, this is specifically for you, is that breaking down in your generation? Is it easier to get mainstream readers, straight people, to be perfectly clear?
Right.
Because I'm finding among my circle of writers, as we all have, are also writers of color, and I had a discussion with a friend of mine who was facing the same thing. She said she cannot get white people to read her books. So is that kind of bias breaking down, hopefully, in your generation?
I mean, I love that you say my generation. I mean,
well, you're certainly younger than I am.
Right. So yes, I mean, I think we had this discussion about your con. We were talking a little about the LGBT, but also about people of color. I mean, this was a conference of easily 1,000 people, and I think I could count on one hand the number of people of color at this conference.
Right.
The joke, we were on a panel about social issues in crime fiction, and you know, our moderator was Gary Phillips, who writes noir out of LA.
Who counts as two?
Very, right, yeah. Well, the joke was his wife was saying they were like, okay, social issues, let's get the one black guy at the conference to moderate. And so we talked a little bit about that. We also had a woman from Singapore named Ovidia Yu.
Oh, yes, I'll be interviewing
her next week. She's fantastic, and we talked a little about Singapore and the censors there. She said that in Singapore, you can't write a gay, you can have one lesbian, but not two. So she was able to write about, a gay relationship because one of the people had been the victim of a crime. But yes, I mean, I think that it, certainly in my generation, anyone younger than me, I'm almost 40, certainly in the millennial generation, I mean, and I think the way to show this is less in books, I think, than in Hollywood. You know, what's the biggest show on TV? It's Transparent, the one that everyone cares, is, you know, really breaking the barriers, right? And that is not just, you know, teaching people or showing people that trans people, for example, are real, you know, just as human as everyone else. I think that for people of my generation and younger, it's just not a big deal in the way that it would be like a gay detective, whatever, the detective, you know, who they have sex with is just one small part. But it is true that and it's not as apparent. I mean, obviously that, you know, there may be, you know, I can't look it out at BafferCon and think how many people or how many LGBT people are there here where I can say, oh wow, there's one black person in this giant room. I don't know. I wonder what if it's publishers who worry that you know, the character who is black or brown or LGBT will not be will not break through, or if it's I think that publishers are getting braver. I mean, I read about Hasidic Jews, which is a tiny community that very few people know about or really care about. And I thought when I you know, tried to write my or sell my book that I would end up with a niche publisher because who cares about this tiny community, but a bigger publisher took it, which I think indicates that, that publishers are more willing to sort of take that chance on the smaller community. But certainly on a day-to-day level, I mean, I don't think, you know, being gay or being a trans or being of color, it's just like, it just doesn't matter. In the, it's not, you know, it's not remarkable in any way. And so I would have to hope that that translates into people's buying habits. And like I said before, you know, it's just really about the curiosity about your fellow human beings. They are, you know, so hopefully people are more curious about their fellow human beings. So I think we're on the up. I think you have to worry less.
How many millennials were there at BabgeCon?
There were, wait, that's a good question. It skewed older, but there were, you know, I was on a panel with a woman who was younger than I am. I'm almost 40. There are definitely some younger writers. Far fewer readers, but some of that has to, I would think, has to do with, you know, the ability to take off of work if you're not, you know, and go to a sort of fan conference, although I guess people could take off work and go to Comic-Con.
You
have to go all the way to New Orleans. Better that than Raleigh was last year.
For what it's worth, Comic-Con, right, you meet the readers where they are.
Right.
And Hard Case Crime is launching this October. In 2 weeks, we're launching a line of comic books. And how are we doing this? We have a comic book that is co-written by a woman named Krista Faust, who is a proud member of the LGBT community, and Gary Phillips.
Awesome.
And it's set in 1980s Times Square, and the cast of characters is about as diverse as you could possibly imagine. And we'll see if the characters who show up in comic book stores want to buy it. I hope they do, but you know what, I'll keep publishing it, I don't care.
Right, well, with the Alice Bledel and now, you know, Black Panther being written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think, like, that sounds really good. I'm ready for you to make a lot of money.
Well, I'm ready for Krista and Gary to make a lot of money.
I have a question about graphic design. Many of us in the room, I'm sure, remember the 1950s and 60s lurid covers of the murder mysteries, the kind of literally
called. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Some of them also will be read in hard copy. And I wonder, I'd like to ask the panel what their judgment is of graphic design. Do they have any say at all on how their books are presented to the public? And about the evolution of print covers over the decades?
Well, the cover of Getting Off, as I recall.
So Hard Case Crime exists for one reason and only one reason. I love the books, but the reason it exists is the covers. And what we have done is revive the cover style of the old 1950s pulps. If you haven't seen our covers, I invite you to go to hardcasecrime.com and you can see them all. Getting Off, the one Parnell mentioned, is a book by Lawrence Block that we published, which has two women and a man and a knife, and not much in the way of clothing. On my way over here, before coming here, I stopped off at a graphic service bureau on 28th Street to have a new cover painting photographed. Why do I have to have a photograph in this day and age of digital art? The reason I have to have a photograph is that it was painted for us by a man who is 90 years old. His name is Robert McGinnis. If you know Robert McGinnis's work, but not necessarily his name, it's because you went to the movies in the 60s and saw Sean Connery's James Bond movies, and you saw the posters for those movies, and Robert McGinnis painted them. And if you went to see Breakfast at Tiffany's, and you remember the movie poster with Audrey Hepburn and the cigarette, he painted that too. And Barbarella and so on. Robert McGinnis is 90 years old. Robert McGinnis is painting the same as he was when he was 27 years old. Beautiful women, not much clothes. And he doesn't have a computer. He doesn't have a fax machine. But he has a paintbrush, and he mailed me a painting, and it's now in the hands of a photographer. I love that kind of art. I might be the only one left, except for you. I wish covers looked like that. I really do. So I do my part, but people want big type, a name, a title, and maybe a little rose.
Well, then to talk about the complaint among many of my fellow female authors is that female authors get a girl on the cover of the book. A girl, usually a girl walking away.
A red coat.
I have two books with a red coat. Most of the time I have very little input almost no input. I mean, I really I thought Gone Girl was frankly a fantastic cover because it's just a suggestion. It's the black cover with the hair. So I tend to like more, I would say, artful books covers. You know, you don't, but a lot of the, unfortunately, I think a lot of really great women writers get sort of more downmarket than book books.
Well, my experience has been it's a matter of the publisher, marketing, and the format. My mysteries started out in the hands of one of the, at the time it was the Big Five, maybe even the Big Six, now the Big Four. And so a very hot art director did, the first book was called Death Will Get You Sober, and it was a wonderful cover. It had a shot glass that they actually shot with a gun. So it's, you know, being shattered and the whiskey is spilling and, you know, the death will get you sober. It was a wonderful cover. It actually, the cover would have won an Anthony, except Dragon Tattoo won everything that year, including the cover. And then, you know, when I got dumped by the big publisher, eventually the mystery series ended up with an ebook publisher, and because they're ebooks, they have to look good as a thumbnail. So you want the type has to be huge. And believe me, when you scroll through a whole bunch of ebooks, you see the mistakes that people make when they put covers that are like bookshelf book covers. We can't read the author's name, we can't read the title. And they did what I thought were wonderful covers, except they didn't go out with a gun and a photographer. You know, they get the pictures out of stock photos, but wonderful covers, and they had the theme was the outline of the body. You know, it wasn't wholly original, but they were great covers and they looked great. And then my publisher decided they weren't selling well enough. And she decided to change the titles, which, I mean, they're wonderful. Death Will Help You Leave Him, Death Will Extend Your Vacation. 11 years later, and it was in the contract, she changes the title to something bland. And she changes the covers to this sardonic looking guy, who is my character, and sort of cozy looking covers with New York scenes. And it didn't make sales go up, it made sales go down, and it also stopped dead the sales of the short stories, which had been published places like Elderly Queen, and I had the rights, and I had them up on Amazon, you know. And anyway, so when sales went down, the publisher dumped me. So then I had the rights to all the books and no money, and I don't have, you know, super duper computer graphic skills. So now all the books and all the stories in the series, I have the rights. I put them all up on Amazon. You can buy them as ebooks on Amazon. And what I did was they're just all different colors, and it's Death Will, and then the name of the book, and there's a bloody knife, and I actually, it's very simple. I got it off a site. I think it's like a Russian mob thing, and that the gun was dripping with blood, which I just erased a little bit. I think it was used in a real murder, but I don't think anybody's going to give me a hard time about the rights. And that is how I got the covers that you can currently see on the Bruce Cola Mystery Series.
If you get that call from Moscow, right. Some big Russian guy's going to show up on your door. We have time for one more quick question. Yes, Karen.
So I've always heard that the writer Mary Roberts Rinehart is like the American Agatha Christie. I've never actually read any of her books. Any of her mysteries. I've read other books of hers, where she holds camping, and which are fantastically funny and wonderful. I'm just curious. Should I read her books? We have some of the
stacks.
Are they worth reading?
Oh,
they're
worth reading.
Oh, really?
I wish she was dead. I am not familiar with her.
I know Mary Roberts Rinehart. The question was, is Mary Roberts Rinehart worth reading? And all I can remember is one short its story. And I remember it being good, but I haven't read the books, which is now I'm going to go out and read.
Well, I'm just curious. Yeah. I also heard that she may have been a person attributed to the phrase the butler did.
Mm.
So I also, well, maybe she's better known as a mystery writer than.
Isn't she the Haddock of Noun? When they talk about the Haddock of Noun School of detective fiction, where the. Where the heroine should have known better.
Yeah, it
stumbles into.
Right, it has a kind of gothic quality to it, where you've got this innocent who has the back of her hand to her forehead, and she says, you know, had I but known, dear reader, I would never have entered upon this course of events that led me astray.
I think that phrase is most associated with Mary Roberts.
I'm gonna try it. You know, I've never been disappointed. I've been disappointed by individual books, but I've never been sorry to pick one up. I've never been sorry. So you put it down again after a chapter if it's not good. Just pick up the book.
Well, you read one while you're eating a sandwich.
This does not sound like a recommendation. We know before going in that the butler did it.
That's right. Had I but known, I wouldn't read more.
All right. With that,
thank you.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time to draw things to a close.
Thank you.
On behalf of Mystery Writers of America, New York Chapter, I'd like to thank, in reverse alphabetical order, Liz Zelda, Parnell Hall, Julia Dahl, and Charles Ardyke for being here this evening. And I'd like to thank you for speaking so cogently, so entertainingly, so fondly. It's much appreciated. With writers this smart, this talented, I think it's safe to say that we're living in another golden age. Five books, good reading. Oh, and I'd like to introduce over to Carolyn Waters for a couple of final closing remarks.
No.
Thanks so much.